Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, Monday morning, July 7th.
Mr. Orr, how are you? Haven't seen you in a while.
It's been a while. It's a pleasure to be here. Good to see you again, Your Honor. May it please the court, Steve Orr from Austin, Texas, for Muhammad Arami. This case presents an interesting issue that I think has not been decided by the Fifth Circuit before. It's been considered by the Eighth Circuit in United States versus Head, which is cited in the brief. And that is where a defendant is entitled to withdraw his plea pursuant to Rule 11D1 and 11D2, but the 11D1 is not raised in trial. Is he allowed to raise that on appeal? And I think clearly that he is, once we look at the situation in this case, that under the facts of this case, under the law that we have, that Mr. Arami should have been allowed to withdraw his plea of guilty. If first we look at the Carr factors on 11D2, Mr. Arami clearly on several occasions at the motion to withdraw hearing and its sentencing asserted his innocence. If we look at the plea itself, what we see is that the normal procedures for pleading guilty were not followed. That is, that there was no signed factual basis. There was a signed plea agreement. On page, I think it's 25, 26 of the hearing of the rearrangement, Mr. Arami's attorney says something to the effect of, well, yes, that's our factual basis, and we didn't do a lot that's in there. We don't have knowledge of a lot of it, but that's what we agree is the factual basis the government would show at trial. Then the judge asks Mr. Carruth, is that okay with you? And Mr. Carruth says, yes, that's correct. And then the judge asks Mr. Arami, is that what you did? And he says, yes. Now, we consider this against a background that Mr. Arami, although now a U.S. citizen, is a native of Iran, and his native language is Farsi, and he speaks pretty good English. That's pretty clear from the record, but it's also pretty clear from the record that he doesn't speak perfect English. Neither do I, of course, but then I have no excuse. So Mr. Arami soon decides to withdraw his plea. He doesn't get a motion on file for 55 days, as Mr. Gay is fond of pointing out in every opportunity he's got. But under 11D1, I don't think it matters, because under D1, the simple truth is that there is no time limit. It says any time before the plea is accepted. And in this case, at the rearrangement, Judge Pittman said, I'm going to recommend to the district judge that your plea is of guilty, that is, Mr. Arami and Mr. Balderas, be accepted.
Isn't your 11D1 argument much better than your 11D2 argument?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think it's pretty gold. I think it's probably one of the best arguments I've ever had up here, but then I've thought that before and lost. So what
Mr.
I think
or is, if we're doing this under plain error review, which we are on 11D1, if the error is so plain, how did a seasoned district judge, a prosecutor, and it looks like two different defense attorneys miss it?
I think until you get to looking at the record with some clarity, you don't understand how Judge Sparks, if you don't understand how Judge Sparks does it, that is that he doesn't, the plea is not accepted until sentencing. So if you don't have the record in front of you, and maybe even if you do, you don't get all that. I think that.
Right, but what I'm saying is that you're here on a plain error review standard on the 11D1 argument, right?
Unfortunately.
And so there was a lot of proceedings about withdrawing the plea that were under 11D2, I understand. But I'm saying, how come no one in the trial court recognized this issue, the 11D1 issue, until, I think, the supplemental brief in the Fifth Circuit, if it's so obvious?
Well, I think there's a difference between obvious and plain. I think probably Judge Sparks may have known about, probably did know about 11D1. But since the trial counsel didn't raise it, he only raised 11D2, I think that's how it never got mentioned in the record. I think probably Sparks did understand that, or maybe he didn't understand it. I don't know. But if I can rely on the Head case from the Eighth Circuit, basically they made it pretty clear there that it is plain error not to raise, if you don't raise 11D1 until appeal, because it's something the district judge should have known, or should have noticed, and it's something that is not only it's an abuse of discretion, because basically the trial judge has no discretion not to grant a motion that's well-founded under 11D1.
Well, I'm just quoting from United States versus Garcia Flores. Plain error is so obvious and substantial that failure to notice and correct it would affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. So the concept of obviousness is inherent in plain error.
Well, I understand, but in every case of plain error, any plain error before the circuit court is going to be something that nobody noticed or raised in the district court. That's how we get to have to argue plain error. I mean, it's always some problem that it may have been, it maybe should have been obvious, but nobody noticed it. I mean, we work hard down the district courts. It's not easy. And that's why we have the Fifth Circuit here to catch these errors. And I think clearly an error was made below. It is plain now that we look at it. I mean, but in any situation of plain error, it's not going to be plain until we look at it on appeal. If it was so easy to do what all of us do, the district judge, the defense counsel, and counsel for the government, we wouldn't need the Fifth Circuit. So I urge that it truly meets the definition of plain error. And the only precedent is the Head case, which says basically that the judge had no discretion not to grant the motion under 11D1.
Have any other circuits besides the Eighth Circuit addressed this and come out the other way?
Not that we could find. And I had one of my young lawyers, who's actually a good lawyer. He's the ventriloquist.
As opposed to the other lawyers? Or what?
No, they're all good lawyers there. They're all the ventriloquist. I'm the dummy. So they did a research last week. They turned on the computer and ran through all that. We don't find any case other than Head that has considered anything like this. There are cases, of course, that talk about Rule 11, and the Fifth Circuit's considered Rule 11 many times.
Can you explain to me why it is that the judge doesn't accept the plea until the sentencing? You referred to some other case that the judge had gone in the Fifth Circuit, but that's unclear to me, why the judge doesn't, in the meantime, accept the master's report and accept the plea before the sentencing.
That's your Honor's referring to the Foy case, which I actually had the honor of representing Mr. Foy in district court, and then he got another lawyer on appeal who reversed it. And what happened in Foy was that Mr. Foy got a pretty good plea agreement, pled guilty. Judge Sparks didn't like the agreement, set it aside. We had a jury trial. Mr. Foy got an extra, 10 or 12 years for having gone to trial instead of being sentenced under his plea agreement. And the court there, I believe, indicated that once the plea agreement was accepted, that the judge couldn't set it aside. And so ever since then, what Judge Sparks has done, and we cited on a couple of district court cases where he just did it recently, he doesn't accept the report and recommendation until sentencing. He wants to see the pre-sentence report.
Does he do this all the time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Does Judge Spark ever take his own guilty pleas, or are automatically all referred to the magistrate?
It varies. He takes some of his own, and some of them go to the magistrate. I think it depends on how busy he is.
I mean, if he were to say something, if he were to take his own guilty plea and say, I'm going to accept this subject to looking at the pre-sentence report, or some language of that type, would we have a problem here?
Well, I think that'd be a closer case, but he could maybe make a distinction between accepting the plea and accepting the plea agreement. Then again, on the other hand, if he says, well, I'm going to consider the plea agreement later, assuming the defendant's got some sort of 11C1C cap, and then he decides he doesn't want to do that, so he sets aside the plea agreement, then the defendant goes back to having an absolute right to set aside his plea of guilty. So in other words, Judge Sparks has made a decision here, a choice, about how he's going to proceed, because he wants to have the ability not to accept these pleas and or plea agreements until he's seen the PSI, until he's seen what happens at sentencing. And he does that. I cited a couple of cases that just recently decided by him in district court, where he set aside the plea agreements.
Is this, just as a practical matter, is this opening the window to someone pleading guilty 2 or 3 months, 4 months later, when they get the PSI and they see the guidelines and the sentence they're going to get, say, whoa, wait a minute, I'll change my mind. I don't want to plead guilty after all and withdraw their plea. I mean, wouldn't this start an avalanche of these types of situations?
I suppose anything's possible, but Judge Sparks certainly has a way, that the magistrates and Judge Sparks have a way not to do that. They just simply accept the plea at the rearrangement, at the plea of guilty. That's all they've got to do.
Can a magistrate accept a plea?
I think the magistrate can accept it, and I suppose that all that can be. No, I'm not sure the magistrate can accept it. But in any event, the magistrate could certainly do it, send a report and recommendation. The judge could say, I accept it. Within the, you know, if nobody complains, he could accept it at any time, I suppose. He could enter an order accepting the magistrate's recommendation, which would give a smaller window of opportunity to defendants. I don't think most defendants are going to want to do that. I mean, some of them do. But most of them plead guilty because, number one, they are guilty. They don't make any assertions of innocence, as Mr. Rahmi has. And most of them don't want to face trial in federal court. I mean, that's why we get mostly pleas of guilty anymore in criminal cases.
Well, and I realize we went off on the 11D1, but you bring up the 11D2 point, which is that he says that he's innocent. And I understand the issue with language issues and so forth, but as you say, he speaks English, I think, certainly well enough to understand the word guilty. And he stood there in front of a magistrate and said, oh, yes, I'm. What did he think he was saying he was guilty of?
I think he thought maybe he was pleading guilty only to the money laundering, and the plea agreement has in there all this stuff about visiting prostitutes, and it has some other stuff in there. It has some stuff in there, I think, that would indicate that he did some stuff that I think he didn't do. I mean, it's just, I mean, who knows? How do we know? We can't tell from the record. So at this stage, I think it's, if we can't tell from the record, if it's not clear in the record what he pled guilty to, then we're just speculating about what was in his mind, and we can't, I don't think we should do
that. I think the record's very clear what he pled guilty to. I'm asking you what he is contending now, because he says he was confused and he didn't understand and so forth. But if you read the transcript of the magistrate Rule 11 hearing, he repeatedly said, yes, he's guilty, that there were some facts about other defendants that he doesn't really know much about. That certainly came out. But that, yes, he's pleading guilty. And the magistrate did, in fact, read what the charge was, which was that he knowingly accepted money for a house of prostitution, in essence. And now he's saying he didn't know the money was for a house of prostitution. And I thought that was very clear, really, from the Rule 11 hearing.
Well, he does say that at the Rule 11 hearing. It's I think it's unclear because there is an unsigned factual basis. His lawyer answers, and I just don't think it's all that clear because I do a lot of pleas of guilty, which is about all you can do in federal court most of the time. You just give up quickly and hope for the best. Try to get your client the best. It's almost malpractice, especially on something like this. Most of the time, or drug cases, to have a jury trial. Although I've done a few. The point being that. There is no signed factual basis. It's not right into the record. Normally, when you plead somebody guilty in the Austin Division, there's either the signed factual basis or the unsigned factual basis is right into the record. So I just respectfully disagree that it's clear in the record what you pled guilty to. The only thing where they get into some details is at the what style of motion to withdraw or motion to substitute counsel hearing. Or he says, I didn't understand all this. He said, I didn't agree, and puts in the motion to withdraw that I didn't get $30,000.
But under an 11D2 analysis, Judge Sparks found him not to be credible, and we would give deference to that finding, wouldn't we? I'm not talking about the 11D1, but just on the question of the 11D2 standard, if that's all we were looking at.
Well, I'm in front of Judge Sparks a lot, and I love Judge Sparks. I mean, I enjoy being there. He's a fun judge. He's my second favorite district judge. Unfortunately, they took my most favorite district judge and put him on the Fifth Circuit.
And we're glad to have him.
But the point is that the reason we have jury trials is because that defendants have a right not to rely on the opinion of district judges as to whether they're guilty or not. In this case, this man it took him a little while, 55 days. But he wanted to have a jury trial and asserted his innocence.
I have a question about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
As a practical matter, he's been serving already a year of a 27-month sentence, and now he wants a jury trial on multiple counts. Is that the relief you seek in this case?
I have counseled with him, obviously, on many occasions about that, and that is what he wants.
The relief you want is a jury trial on the whole thing.
That's correct. And if I might, I might point out, we have filed a motion for bond pending appeal, which was denied, and I do re-urge that so we can solve some of that.
Is he a U.S. citizen?
He's a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's no issue about
deportation
if he gets convicted or has a conviction on his record. That's not an issue.
For an innocent man, he's done enough time, and I'm hoping that y'all would at least let him back out on bond pending the opinion here, because if we take who knows how long that will take, but he could discharge his time. So he's a good person, good citizen, businessman, never been in trouble in his life other than one some minor, very minor thing, selling alcohol to a minor, I think. And so I would urge that this case be reversed for the grounds that I've stated. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Joseph Gay from the Western District of Texas. I'd like to begin by addressing the issue of this factual basis. And I think I would like to point to page 10 of our brief. And specifically, Magistrate Judge Pittman says, Mr. Army, similarly, has there been a factual basis? There's been a factual basis filed in your case. Have you had the opportunity to read what the government says that they believe they could have shown had this case gone to trial? And Mr. Rami's counsel says, for the record, Your Honor, there's much in this very lengthy and complicated factual basis that we believe to be true because it's information provided to us by the government from parts of this operation that Mr. Rami had no knowledge of personally. The provisions specifically relate to him on page 7 are accurate, and we don't have any dispute about those at all. So the idea that he didn't sign the factual basis or that it wasn't read, if you go through the Rule 11 colloquy, in fact, everybody agreed that they didn't have to read this lengthy factual basis, that they would all focus in on the factors, facts set forth on page 7 of that factual basis. And so to say that he didn't know what he was pleading guilty to, I think, is really not a fair reading of the Rule 11 colloquy. Turning to the more interesting question, this is a case which intersects the practice of magistrate judges exercising their power to take pleas, and then finally a district court's accepting of the plea at some time thereafter.
Do you agree that the magistrate judge does not have the power to take the plea, as your opposing counsel stated?
Has the power to take the plea but not
accept the plea.
Yes. United States versus Dees is this right. Court's opinion that specifically sets forth, and I think that's what really kind of makes this case very unusual and, in fact, a very important case, because if, in fact, Rule 11D1 is given the operative effect in cases in which a defendant waives his right to have his plea taken by a district court judge, then in every case, no matter they're up until the time that the plea is formally accepted by the district court, they have an absolute right to withdraw. And so what I have argued is that in situations where a magistrate issues his report and recommendation, and you're given the 10-day warning that says you have 10 days to file objections, otherwise you're subject to plain error review, and you don't do those things, and you wait 55 days, and basically you read the pre-sentence report and you change your mind, and now we're 14 months later after the April 7th hearing that was conducted, to say that now you automatically get to wipe out everything that you did and start over is very prejudicial and a very troubling.
It's taking 14 months for
as of today from the time
PSRs?
That yes the okay. From the hearing where Judge Sparks denies the motion to withdraw was April 6th, and we're 14 months from there of 2007.
Well, I'm saying, maybe I'm misunderstanding the 14 months. The PSR does not take that long.
No,
it only took
days.
A few weeks,
yeah.
A couple months. But I guess what I'm wondering, it sounded from what Mr. Orr was saying, that Judge Sparks would like the opportunity to review the PSR before he decides whether to accept the plea. So to some extent, does it make sense that in that circumstance, if the judge wants that, then the defendant should also have that? Because that your argument is we shouldn't let the defendant sit around and wait and see how things are going to turn out and then decide to withdraw his plea. But as Mr. Orr said, can't the judge sort of fix that by himself accepting the plea before there's a PSR and before the defendant has a chance to change his mind? If that's a problem.
It's an interesting question, and I've read the cases regarding Rule 11 and guilty pleas. Ordinarily, if you were pleading guilty before a district court judge, and a district court judge accepts your guilty plea at the time of taking the plea, I believe that all pleas are provisionally accepted until the time of sentencing, and the district court always has the opportunity to reject that plea. I believe that district court judges.
We're talking about the plea agreement or the plea of guilty. Aren't those two different things, though, related?
I believe interrelated, yes. And I think that clearly the district court has the opportunity to not accept the guilty plea and the agreement, even though if it was accepted, I believe the district court still retains up till the time of sentencing the ability to say, you know, after looking at this, I'm not going to accept this plea.
But the problem we have here is that it wasn't before the district judge. It was before the magistrate. If the district judge would have heard the plea and said, I'll conditionally accept it or something of that nature, we have some sort
it would
of
be under
acceptance.
D2. Yes.
But since it was before the magistrate and the magistrate recommended that the district judge accept it and no action had been taken, then do we not have a situation where it has not been accepted?
Oh, I think clearly the plea was not accepted in this case. In fact, it was accepted on the morning of sentencing. I think the record is very stark, and there's no way to get around that. And so what we have is sort of an odd situation where we are facing the intersection between Rule 11 D1, magistrate judges taking the plea, and plain error. And so if you look through the record, and let's just go ahead and look at the D2 factors, which I believe really are akin to the prejudice prong that we would be looking at, or at least under the plain error standard, the manifest miscarriage of justice. And I believe that if you look at the Carr factors as they were espoused by the district court in its decision to deny, I think those are the reasons why this court shouldn't reach out and reverse Mr. Arami's plea.
Why are we interposing the Carr factors in the D1 context when it states on its plain, on its face, absolute right?
Yes. Under the plain error standard of review, this court may, in its discretion, notice errors that affect the judicial integrity, fairness of the proceedings. And my point was merely that if you looked at the factors the district court enunciated, those are very similar to the arguments that I would make as to why this court should not exercise its discretion under a plain error standard of review to reverse this case. Because ultimately, as I pointed out, 14 months have elapsed since Mr. Arami sought to withdraw his plea. 55 days after he had pleaded guilty, it was the first time he even raised this issue in district court.
How do you reconcile that with the Washington case and the De Leon case?
I believe that in as far as I can tell, there are no cases which intersect magistrate judges and the unique facts of our case.
No, we're talking about people who say they're innocent and want to withdraw their plea before it's accepted. In each of those cases, the court noted specifically that the person hadn't said they were innocent, and that is exactly precisely the situation we're presented with here.
And as Judge Sparks pointed out, he finds his claims, after looking at the record, to be uncredible. And I think if you look at what he said during the Rule 11 colloquy, his claims of innocence are late, and courts have focused on the fact that the longer the delay, the less credible they are.
But aren't you basically saying we just shouldn't have 11D1, that it's inefficient to allow? I mean, I can see what happens here. You're set for trial. You're fixing to go to trial. You run out and plead guilty, thereby, in essence, getting a continuance you might not have been able to get had you asked for it. And then you turn around and withdraw your plea of guilty. That seems to be inefficient and unhelpful to the process. But that's the rule. So I guess I'm trying to understand, you seem to think the rule kind of shouldn't be there, but it's there and we have to follow it. And it is very, the rule is very plain.
I agree entirely with what you've just said. I think the rule is very clear. It says, for no reason, I don't think it could be any clearer, the question becomes what happens in cases where, like this case, you plead guilty, you waive your right to have a district court judge take your plea. So in every one of those cases, your plea cannot be accepted until some point later. And then you're given your 10-day warning after the report and recommendation comes out. You're warned that if you have an objection to this, for example, oh, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have pled guilty because I'm really innocent, and you don't do that, then you waive the right to have anything other than plain error review. And I think that that's what the whole point comes down to, is that this, in a situation, if this had been before the district court judge and the district court judge had not accepted the plea and waited till sentencing, I think that's a different case. Or had the district court judge taken the plea and accepted it at the time, obviously you would never have the situation come up. But in the unique facts of this case where you have a magistrate judge taking the plea, which the defendant consents to. That's where the Rule 11D1 and the rules regarding the taking of pleas and the reports and recommendations by the magistrate judges intersect and are very difficult to
Could a remedy for future cases, if we were to rule against the government, the referral to the magistrates include a waiver of the magistrate's ability to accept a plea, or the magistrate send something to the district judge in a couple of days and the district judge sign off that he accepts the plea pursuant to the magistrate's recommendation instead of sitting on it for 3 or 4 months?
I will say this. I know anecdotally that since this issue has arisen, that routinely now district court judges are entering orders accepting pleas within following the 10 days. I have seen that. I'm not so sure that because of the Article 3 jurisdictional issues relating to the taking of pleas by magistrate judges, that there's anything that can be done that doesn't as long as it doesn't interfere with a plea must be reviewed and accepted by the district court judge. And so until that happens, I'm not sure how, for Rule 11 purposes, for D1, maybe the court could fashion something. But certainly, no matter what, the district court judge does have to formally accept the plea before to satisfy Article 3 concerns.
Has any court in any jurisdiction ever followed your proposed 10-day rule and you've waived it in this context?
No. In fact, you know, in civil cases, of course, or in they're all absolutely.
Right, absolutely.
You know, it is truly, if you don't, you know, those findings are just set against you and you're really up against a plain error review.
Here on the 11D1 argument, Arami or Arami?
Arami, I believe.
Mr. Arami is not challenging on his 11D1 argument the findings of the magistrate. The magistrate just finds, well, it was knowing and it was voluntary and he wasn't coerced and those kinds of issues. That's not really what's being challenged. What's being challenged here is he's an absolute right to withdraw it. So that's great. It was knowing, voluntary, and all this kind of stuff, but it wasn't accepted. And therefore, he has the right to withdraw it. So I'm wondering how this whole 10-day with the magistrate findings makes any difference to the 11D1 argument.
The 11D1 argument is essentially that by waiving your right to have your plea taken by a district court judge, inevitably that plea has to be accepted at some later date. And so you're given 10 days, and that's what the notice is given to the parties. And my argument is, and perhaps this court can obviously not follow it, is that if you don't object to the report and recommendation, the warning actually specifically addresses plain error. And I believe that under those circumstances that you essentially as a defendant can't really avail yourself of the mandatory provisions of D1, but that you would certainly be able to go in, as you always were able to, and argue under D2 that you have just and compelling reasons for the withdrawal of
your plea.
But
don't you think if Mr. Arami is going to waive 11D1 that he should be told that when he accepts a magistrate? And he certainly wasn't. In fact, it didn't look like he even knew about 11D1, and we question whether counsel knew about it since counsel certainly never raised it. And so how could he be waiving? He agrees to a magistrate to basically have a plea colloquy under Rule 11. That's all he agreed to. He didn't agree, and I also waive 11D1 and a half a dozen other things. He waived certain rights on appeal. When he gives the plea, he waives the right to have a district judge actually have the plea colloquy under Rule 11. I don't see anything there, and maybe you can point to me in the record, where he also waived his rights under 11D1 or ever knew about them until someone figured that out sometime in the appellate process.
I know from the reading of the Rule 11, from the motion to withdraw, his counsel says, quite frankly, Judge, this is an abuse of discretion. I know you have discretion whether or not to do this. Everyone was operating under the assumption that they were under D2. There's nothing in the record that would show that anybody contemplated the mandatory provisions of D1. It's just that this case, because it was never raised, and for the first time in a supplemental brief before this court, I think that under a plain error standard of review, that under the substantial rights prong, that Mr. Arami has failed to establish, if you look at the Rule 11 proceedings and everything that took place, that this is a case in which there was a manifest miscarriage of justice, that in fact the record really does show that he pled guilty, he knew exactly what he was pleading guilty to, and that on balance, as of today, if there's going to be a trial of this case, and I think Judge Sparks pointed that out back in April of 07, that there are significant prejudicial aspects to this case going forward. And so what we have is a situation, an issue that was never raised, coming up now, and the effect would be essentially that the government will be put to trial in a much, much later.
But
obviously,
Mr. Arami is taking a rather huge gamble himself. But
absolutely.
But the right to trial by jury and the right to come in and have a jury of your peers is a very significant right. And he's asking for that knowing that, I mean, we can all objectively question his decision here. But I guess I'm wondering, does that lend credibility to the whole thing that he's doing? He's already sat in jail half the sentence he would have gotten under the plea if the plea agreement had been taken and if the guidelines had been followed or not varied or departed from in any way. And so it seems to me, does that lend some credibility to his protestations that he should have this right and he should not be considered to have waived something he didn't know about, his counsel didn't know about, the judge apparently didn't bring up or think was appropriate to mention, and the prosecutor either didn't know about or didn't think he had a duty to raise?
I don't disagree that by vacating this plea and subjecting himself to the entire indictment, Mr. Arami is subject to a lot of additional time should a jury convict him. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Whether that adds credibility to his claim, I guess it's just speculation. The main, at the end of the day, I think this court, because of this Rule 11D1, which really has never been explored in the context of pleas being taken by a magistrate judge, the best thing that can happen is that we do have guidance from this court, so the district courts and magistrate judges and the parties will be well aware of what path and the implications of those two unique things, that is waiving your right to have a district court judge take the plea and Rule 11D1, and how the rules regarding the report and recommendation intersect, and whether maybe that warning in the context of a guilty plea doesn't have any effect at all. Maybe I'm not sure exactly what that warning means. If it doesn't mean that you waive, it essentially warns the parties that you waive your right to challenge under anything other than plain error. And so maybe it's just this case presents an interesting issue that I don't think this court or any other court has addressed. And I think that you are well aware of what the issues are. It's just a question of which path to take.
If the district court had not made the determination that Mr. Arami was not credible, would you concede that the error affected his substantial rights? You rely a lot on the fact that the district court found him not credible. Is that the linchpin of your argument?
It's part of the linchpin of my argument. I think that part of the analysis of whether you, when you assert your innocence, I think the length of delay courts have recognized is one of the things that is looked at to determine the strength or the weakness of that and the circumstances. For example, you get your pre-sentence report, and obviously in many cases defendants are unhappy with the prospects of the sentence they're recommending, that sort of thing. And so, yes, at the end of the day, I think that credibility finding is an important part of it, but of course, once again, we're back to the D2. That's where the judge sort of makes those findings, and so it is an important finding of the district court, as well as all the others, that basically, you know, he knows what he was pleading guilty to. There was no doubt that he understood. He was asked, and he pled guilty, and stated.
But I mean, 11D1 would let him, you know, just like have his second thoughts about it.
That's true. If before the plea is accepted, that's correct, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Mr. Rahmi may not have been credible to Judge Sparks, but he's credible, I think, to himself, and I think Judge Haynes is exactly right. I think that's a pretty good, if I understood your question. But anybody who wants to run the kind of risk Mr. Rahmi would be running by going to trial clearly believes in his own innocence. And we allow jury trials in this country for people who are innocent or guilty, no matter what. And clearly under 11D1, he was entitled to withdraw the plea. Nobody said the magic words in district court. I think we could presume that Judge Sparks, being an Article III judge, would have better knowledge of this than Mr. Kennan. And so far as the 55 days, it has nothing to do with it, although Mr. Rahmi had to substitute counsel and get all this together. It's not easy to do that. Simple fact is that, to be honest, I almost didn't take the case, because I know the difficulties in setting aside a plea and appealing that sort of thing. You border on frivolous. But now that I've looked at the law and the record here, I think that Mr. Rahmi is entitled to set aside his plea. I think the law in this circuit since 1966 really has been, although that was, I guess, under Rule 32, the De Leon case, has been that in the situation similar to this, that in the interest of fairness, in the interest of presenting to the public the appearance of fairness and as well as the substance of fairness, that somebody who somewhere in the process before sentencing asserts his innocence ought to be allowed to withdraw his plea of guilty. And that's why we have that rule. That's why we have 11D1, I think. That's why the United States Supreme Court promulgated that rule. So to cut through all the car factors and all the other things that somebody might have used against them in setting aside their plea of guilty, that before the plea is accepted, you have an absolute right to set aside your plea. If the district judge can hold off on accepting your plea of guilty for 2 months or 3 months or whatever it is until sentencing, and then he can decide whether or not he's going to accept your plea, it seems to me only fair that the defendant ought to be allowed to set it aside. So far as Judge Prado's concern about how many people are going to be doing this, I personally don't think too many people would be doing it. But if they do, they have a right under the rule to do that. And the remedy for that would be to change the rule or change the procedure. There's a way out of all this. But we're presented with the facts of this case. In this situation, Mr. Rahmi, early enough, maybe it took him 55 days, but he did say he was innocent and want to proceed to trial. And everybody in the district court warned him of what risk he was taking. But nevertheless, he wanted to proceed to trial. And I don't think it's up to district judges or defense counsel to tell people that they absolutely can't go to a jury trial. I think that my job, for instance, is to tell people, I think you don't have much chance at a jury trial, and you probably ought to take the plea. But the simple fact is I've had several cases where I tell people to plead guilty and don't even think of a jury trial, and they insist on a jury trial and they were found not guilty. Most of the time they get two or three times as much time as they would have if they pled guilty, but it happens often enough. And at some point in this country, we just have to say, you may be a complete idiot, but you want a jury trial, and we're going to give you a jury trial. That's what the Constitution is all about.
Mr. Orr, let me ask you, you had added to your argument at the end that you wanted to re-urge bond for your client in the event that you were successful. If he gets bond, does he lose credit for all the time he's been incarcerated? Because he'll break his time in service and starts all over again, and he's never been found guilty. Then withdraw his plea, and does he start all over again?
I think he'd get credit for it.
You hope?
Well,
hypothetical, because of course he could get acquitted.
I could get lucky. I've won cases up here before. It's hard to believe, but I don't know. I guess who knows what the law is on that, but I don't see how anybody could not give him the credit because it'd be so rare that somebody actually gets bond pending appeal. Actually, I'd like him to have what urge that he get bond pending an opinion, because as opposed to just even whether we win or not. But
give us 14 months, we'll get it out.
Thank you for that encouraging word there, Your Honor. I think Your Honors understand all this, probably a lot better than I understand it, but I would urge that this case be reversed and that we see Mr. Rahm again in district court for proceedings. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.